This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Julian Price was born into money, but spent most of his life giving it away. His grandfather was the man behind the biggest corporation in North Carolina in the early 20th century, Jefferson Standard Life Insurance. But Julian didn't want to live in his family's shadow. He spent his early adult life in Oregon and Northern California, but eventually felt the call to come back to the Tar Heel State. He moved to Asheville in 1989 and quietly became one of the central forces behind the city's redevelopment. He formed Public Interest Projects, a philanthropy organization behind many of the city's treasured landmarks, Malaprop's Books, the Orange Peel, and restaurants like Salsa and the Laughing Seed. Julian passed away in 2001, and a new documentary about his life and legacy premieres at the Orange Peel in Asheville tomorrow night. We're going to preview it today, and joining me first is Julian Price's widow, Meg McLeod. Meg, welcome to the State of Things.
Hey, thanks.
Let's take the story right back to the beginning. Tell us a bit about Julian's family and the environment he grew up in.
Julian grew up in a family of wealth, and they had a big old house in a nice neighborhood. And his dad was a very quiet and kind man. And Julian told me that he traveled the world at one point, convincing world leaders like Indira Gandhi to try to stop the atom bomb. And
we should point out that nice house and neighborhood he grew up in was in Greensboro, right?
That's right. And Julian really liked to just, at first he told me that there were children in his neighborhood, I'm not sure exactly how that worked, but anyway, there were children of African-American kids and other kids of different classes that he liked to play with at school, and then his mother sent him to a private school. And he always felt like that he couldn't quite do good enough for his mom. And so he sometimes doubted himself all through his life. But before he left Greensboro, he asked his dad if he could take over the radio station, and he did turn it into a popular classical music station in Greensboro before he left and dabbled in different things like that.
And he stuck with it, at least the radio part of it. We're going to talk a bit more about that. But eventually, it seems from the story that I've heard that he wasn't very comfortable with his family's legacy, and the wealth was something else that made him somehow uncomfortable.
Well, his name was the same name as his granddad. Julian Price was his granddad's name and his name, too. So just because of his own personality, you know, we all come in with our own things, and then we are shaped by the influences around us as we grow up. He had a lot of insecurities and was very, very sensitive anyway, and so he didn't really want to be, he never liked to be in the public eye. He didn't like people looking at him. It just made him uncomfortable. And then also because, as you know, in our culture, which is a lot influenced by Protestant work ethic, and that work ethic makes people, a lot of people in our country, feel that people with wealth, especially inherited wealth people, maybe got a lot of their wealth by stepping on little people. And so there's just a lot of, I've experienced anyway, in the movies, you don't see many real kind, wealthy people, especially of inherited wealth people. So he also didn't want to be around people that knew that he had inherited wealth. And so that's a big reason why he left and went across the country. They went up to Boston first and then went across the country.
Then in Northern California and Oregon, where he became very interested in issues around sustainable environment, sustainable farming. Tell us about how that interest grew.
Well, when he was in Greensboro, David Waller, who lives here, told me that his mother would tell him stories. They were in the Greensboro area, of Julian roaring up on his motorbike in the 70s to stuff envelopes and help out with a project to save North Carolina farmland with the farmers. And then when he was in California, there's letters in the Julian Price papers at the UNCA library of him donating huge amounts, very personal relationship with a farm association that was trying to get crops directly to the customer. And then he went from there to having communities be more walkable. He did a bunch of radio, created a bunch of radio programs that came out of interviews that he did with people that he read about all over the country. Three of them were from North Carolina. Some of them were from the people in California, Peter Calthorpe, about multimodal. Peter Calthorpe developed one of the first multimodal development communities where to make it easy for people to get around without having a car. A guy that rehabilitated a island over 20 years to reestablish the flora and the fauna that was there before a lot of devastation from other developers.
When you talked about that radio show and the interviews that he did, I mean, these are the many contradictions, because we hear over and over again how shy he was and how he wanted to stay out of the public eye. But he liked the fact of his personality and the ability to communicate and communicate through radio. One of the interviews that we have a little piece of here, he's talking with a mushroom grower in Northern California. Let's listen.
It's just so long to wait, and then all of a sudden you go out there and you got mushrooms, and you got to pick them sometimes twice a day, and then you got to package them and cool them and store them and try to sell them. And if you just don't enjoy it, it just a big hassle.
And they used to hold back their old drought-resistant seed for the anticipation of droughts and be able to make it through droughts. But after the Green Revolution replaced those varieties with hybrids, they're no longer available. And that's why most of the people starved during the drought. Not that nothing would grow, but nothing they had would grow.
I'm Julian Price. These stories and more coming up on This Land of Ours.
And in fact, that story is out of Sugar Hill, North Carolina, about sustainable farming there. But I think you were just about to say something, Meg.
That's what I was about to say.
Okay. Well, but the idea that he had these radio shows and he did want to communicate. I mean, that was something else. Telling the story seemed very important to Julian, that if you're going to develop these ideas about sustainable agriculture, walkable cities, it's one thing to seed the projects, but it's quite another to get the story out there. And he felt that was very important too, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And he when you listen to his interviews, he's really in the background. He was a master interviewer. He just found ways to question the people and just let them go to tell their story. He really wanted to get people that can make choices to know about those stories. As a matter of fact, he paid for the City Council of Asheville to go, the whole City Council, to go to a livable cities convention so that they could hear the stories themselves instead of him always having to do it.
Also socially conscious, very interested in issues of race relations in the South. And here is an excerpt of an interview that he did with the former KKK exalted Cyclops C.P. Ellis. This is the Durham chapter of the KKK. An amazing story about C.P. Ellis transforming from a KKK member to work with an African-American woman named Ann Atwater to develop an actual desegregation plan for Durham. That story in itself is incredible, but Julian decided to interview C.P. Ellis, and here's an excerpt from that.
And at that time, I was extremely bitter, and I was looking for an enemy. And conveniently, there were black people who were convenient for me to take my problems out on. I began to blame all my problems on black people. They were the enemy, only visible enemy I could find. And so I joined the Klan. And I think one of the most emotional moments of my life was the night that I was initiated into the Klan, because I had been felt like a reject all my life. I had deep inferiority feelings. Life, a whole, has been a disappointment. I think I joined the Klan simply because I had to have an enemy, and black people were there, and they were convenient. And as I stayed in the Klan, now let me tell you what the Klan can do, in my opinion. You meet once a week, and you have your meetings, and you talk about one subject, and that's the enemy, and that's the blacks and the Jewish people. Now, if you meet week after week after week after week, and you talk about people, and that hatred begins to develop, it's got to build up in you. And if you consistently do that every week, then there has to be a point in your life, if you stay in it, that explosion has to happen. There has to be an outlet for that bitterness, an outlet for that hatred.
That's a clip from philanthropist Julian Price interviewing former KKK leader C.P. Ellis, and I'm joined by Julian's widow, Meg McLeod, to preview a new documentary about Julian Price's life and legacy. Sadly, what C.P. Ellis was talking about was a way that extremist groups used to recruit and trade on the resentments of people, white people. Now, sadly, that is mainstream conservative politics, trading on that very resentment, and we see it today in the presidential race. So he was ahead of his time, I guess, in some ways, in understanding the power and the destructive quality of those resentments too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. And that's why one of his main goals with the Community Foundation of Western North Carolina, where he did all of his nonprofit giving, was economic hope for youth. That was one of his, the Dogwood Fund that he created was also about environmental protection and preservation and habitat protection, but also that economic hope for underserved youth.
We'll talk about Julian Price, his life and legacy, a new film about his life, and we'll find out why he came back to North Carolina and what happened when he did, when my conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us.
Come graceful down into the land of milk and honey, and sing, sing songs of South that's sweet and sunny. Please sit back in awe. We are the night pulling our last straw.
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We are talking about the life and legacy of Julian Price, a philanthropist who helped transform downtown Asheville into what it is today. A new documentary about his life premieres tomorrow night at the Orange Peel in Asheville. Still with me is Julian's widow, Meg McLeod. Joining me now is Erin Durham. She's the director of the new documentary, Julian Price, Envisioning Community, Investing in People. Erin, welcome. Good to talk with you.
You too. Thanks so much.
Also with us is Pat Whalen, Julian's former attorney and the president of Public Interest Projects, the real estate development company that Julian founded in 1990. Pat Whalen, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Meg, I want to go back to you. We talked about Julian moving from Greensboro, ultimately the Pacific Northwest, Northern California, and Oregon. Why did he decide to come back to North Carolina?
Well, he had been doing therapy and a lot of other things to make it so that he had the courage and the strength to be able to come back home and be among people who would probably recognize his name. And his mainly what he wanted to do was find a down. He said he wanted to find a place with a downtown. And he had put a deposit down on a condominium in New Bern, North Carolina. He did a road trip there in 89. And New Bern has a little downtown. But then when he came to Asheville, he was standing at the top of Walnut Street there at Haywood Street and gazed down across the valley there and saw the mountains, Beaucatur Mountain in the distance, and these two beautiful but empty buildings on each side of him, which his firm Public Interest Projects later developed. And he burst into tears, and he didn't know why, but he knew that he had to let go of the deposit in New Bern and move to Asheville. And as you said, Asheville was about half boarded up then, and I think he got a bang over the years as he got more and more used to living among people who knew who he was. He really got a bang out of being able to live in a place where he could see the changes that his money and his creativity and his photography and his activism and all the tools that he had. Everybody has tools, and those were the tools that he had. Make a difference in the place where he lived. It's an interesting story of somebody of inherited wealth that finally found a way to live in community with what he had and not be ashamed of it anymore.
Well, and that story is captured in the new documentary, Julian Price, Envisioning Community and Investing in People. And I want to start with a clip from the beginning of the documentary that gives you a sense of the profound impact that Julian had on that community.
Julian Price was a very quiet man, tall, impressive.
I believe he came here with the intention of giving a lot of his money away.
He could have just gone to Europe for the rest of his life or whatever, but instead he chose to invest in a community. He chose to do something with it.
It wasn't just that he was a philanthropist. It was this that he came in, and he irritated people, but they liked him.
People who worked for me called him the Wizard of Oz because they didn't believe that he existed.
That's a clip from the new documentary examining the life and legacy of philanthropist Julian Price. And as I said, Pat Whalen is also with me, Julian's former attorney and the president of Public Interest Projects, which is the real estate company founded in 1990. Pat Whalen, tell me about meeting Julian after he got to Asheville and sort of your meeting and how your relationship got started.
Well, I was Julian's attorney. We went out to lunch, and he told me at the luncheon that he was moving to Asheville, and he wanted to do some useful things for the community, particularly in the area of philanthropy. He wanted to give money away to various local nonprofits. And basically, for the first year or so of our relationship, I just helped him do that. That was really his primary interest. Then about a year into it, he came into the office one day and said, "Pat, I've been thinking about it. And I enjoy what we do with the nonprofits, but I'd like to be more directly involved with what's happening in the community, and I'd like to start investing my money in people and in the community itself."
So this is interesting. It means that in addition to, and I'm sure there are some gifts that continued, but the idea that we could make investments, that he could actually make investments, the money could be paid back in the form of a loan, but ultimately these investments would be strategic and have the community in mind and not just the highest dollar return.
Oh, absolutely. And originally we were looking at making those investments on, a four-county region of the mountains, because the entire mountain region suffered economically then and still does to some extent. But very quickly we realized that Julian didn't have, he wasn't by any stretch the wealthiest man in Asheville. He had at that point probably a little over $10 million we could invest, and we decided to invest it in downtown Asheville because downtown had suffered problems for decades, and we wanted to do it, focus it there, because we could have the biggest bang for the buck by focusing on trying to help revitalize downtown Asheville.
And in part, that had to do with the history of Asheville and restoring those historic institutions was part of that decision, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. At that point, and again, Asheville had been trying to come back from the Depression for over 50 years, and there were a lot of empty buildings downtown. And one of the things we felt was important was to try to help fill those empty buildings with businesses at the sidewalk level that people would find interesting, and then also to renovate the upstairs of some of, we have great buildings in Asheville, and renovate the upstairs of some of those buildings that had been sitting empty for 30, 40 years so that people could live downtown and would kind of add to the life in downtown.
Well, the fascinating part about this story is how Julian and others identified those businesses. It wasn't in a conventional way at all. It was a very personal approach. So let's listen to a clip from the owners of what is now the very popular and very well-known Laughing Seed Cafe.
He approached me pretty much out of the blue at this lunch counter that we had at the YMCA. I used to see him all the time. He was very shy, very quiet. And one day he came up and said, "Do you think you'd be interested in expanding the restaurant?" And I remember hiding behind the lunch counter and calling Joe and saying, "Some guy just came up and said he wants to help us expand the restaurant." Joe was like, that sounds fishy, you know?
He came in. He looked at me and said, "Joe, look in my eyes. This is my card. Come to this meeting on Tuesday at 3:00. And I'm like, okay.
So from a lunch counter at the YMCA, that was now what is now the Laughing Seed Cafe, a clip from the documentary Julian Price, Envisioning Community, Investing in People, that premieres tomorrow night at the Orange Peel in Asheville. So, Pat, tell me a little bit about this way of identifying businesses. Was that it? Julian found people he liked and felt were committed to their business, and those were the people he was going to help?
Well, not totally, no. Certainly that was part of it, but we really, at that point, there were a lot of openings in downtown for interesting businesses because we didn't have a great selection of businesses downtown, although we did have some flagship businesses that stayed downtown even through the worst economic times. So we tried to be somewhat strategic in deciding what downtown needed to add a kind of eclectic mix of local businesses that would be appealing to people to hopefully help people be interested in moving into the residential spaces we were creating in the upstairs. So one of the first businesses that we dealt with besides the Laughing Sea was Malaprop's bookstore. We wanted to have a great local bookstore. They were a very small local bookstore. We were concerned that some of the big national chains would be coming in, and we thought they could be a great anchor for downtown if they could be convinced to grow. And after a few months of convincing, they did agree to move into one of the first buildings we renovated, and since then have done a lot better than even they thought and a lot better than even we thought they would do, and they have become one of downtown's anchors. And we really tried to follow the same kind of pattern with just finding good local entrepreneurs who had the ability to do more if we could help them grow. And typically they would be in situations where, you know, the banks, they were not really creditworthy for a bank loan, but they were the kind of business we could afford to take the risk on with Julian's backing.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And the Orange Peel, of course, having a music venue, a place where you could attract talent and then obviously attract customers, that became one of the venues. I think the story of salsa, too, is an interesting one. Again, Pat, you talk about banks not wanting to touch certain businesses because on paper they just don't look right? They don't match the profile. But I think the story of the way salsa developed is a pretty good one, right? Because there was pretty clear evidence that was doing well and probably could have, you know, deserved the money, right?
Yes. A lot of the businesses, just like Joe and Joan and the Laughing Seed, the thing was they were very small, and with our help, they became much, much larger. It was a very kind of sudden expansion that they were doing, so we tried to help them with managing the businesses. But Salsa was basically a four-seat lunch counter. But it was so popular that people were lined up out the door to get one of those seats. And they didn't really have a credit history that let them get a loan. So Hector Diaz, we met and discussed it. He wanted to expand some, and he couldn't get a bank loan. So he was precisely the kind of business that we wanted to help because he was really one of the great draws for downtown.
And you also stuck with the Laughing Seed longer than most conventional lending institutions would to get them through the worst of times, and they ultimately succeeded. I want to talk to Aaron Durham, the film director, right now, about the process you used to tell this story. You conducted a number of oral history interviews. Tell us about the process, Aaron.
Well, I started in the archives at UNCA. They have the Julian Price papers there, I think over 30 boxes of just stuff that he collected, thank you letters, articles, just he seemed to keep everything. So I got to read over a good amount of that, and then we started the oral histories and interviewed his family and close friends and some people that never met him but that he invested in. So that was pretty incredible and had me hooked. I was hooked.
Yeah, well, tell the story. A number of businesses, I think what we talked about, Salsa, the Laughing Seed, Malaprop's, Orange Peel. The Mountain Express was another one. Aaron, tell us that story.
Well, I think the story goes he walked into Jeff Phobe's office, who was the editor of, what was it called?
Green Line.
It was Green Line before it was Mountain Express. And he asked what Jeff Phobes was doing, what he was interested in. And after he heard a little bit, he said, well, that sounds interesting. Would you like some money? And Jeff was laughing and, you know, oh, okay, sure. And about 20 minutes later, he walks in with a check for $20,000 and invested in him from that moment on continuously and wrote for him, took pictures for him. He wasn't just the kind of philanthropist that gave money. He also worked with the people that he helped, whether it was planting flowers in Pritchard Park or really getting down and dirty in the investigatory journalism.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. And Meg McLeod, what has become the Mountain Express, was very interested in environmental issues, which I think is something Julian was interested in as well. And also, I think there's a moment in the film where the editor says, you know, he could see I was making trouble, and I think he liked to make trouble. Meg, is that true? It's somebody who really wanted to stir things up as a journalist.
Yeah, that's interesting, because he got into a lot of trouble from the very beginning when he was talking about making downtown more walkable for people. He said the first thing we need to do is make it walkable for people. And one of the store owners who was also on the downtown commission said later to me, we thought he was crazy. We thought he was nuts. Nobody cares about walkers. Nobody wants to walk. And so he tried for a couple of years just directly to the city workers, the staff, and one particular person, the public works director, was just totally not interested. Basically, Julian got very, very, very little movement from the city until he finally, that's when he started doing City Watch magazine to take what he was hoping for the city to a larger audience and also get their ideas. So he started immediately asking for their ideas about how do you experience the city responsiveness and where are problems in the city that you found, pedestrian or tree health or whatever. And he got tons of answers. And then those ideas, he would get the information, he would go out and meet with the people, take pictures, and then a lot of times those problems would go into the Mountain Express. They had Jeff, the publisher of Mountain Express, did a thing called Dysfunction Junction in there. And Julian, those ideas would go into that little piece in the paper. And then also Julian began to be the assignment editor for the Mountain Express because he had so many cool and quirky ideas of little things that bother people, but big powers that be don't tend to think are very important.
And he had a great way of bringing those to the attention of the powers that be. When you talked about making Asheville more walkable, if they weren't going to read the paper, they were going to sit in a wheelchair. Listen to this.
He contributed with every aspect of his breath.
Julian was a big pedestrian activist, and he was very effective.
Some people say he got a bunch of city council members, put them in wheelchairs, and asked them to roll around town over the curbs to show them just how difficult it was.
He used to send pictures in of intersections that were not handicapped accessible.
He was the one that, you know, rented the wheelchairs. We were all out there. So it was really funny.
That's a clip from the new documentary, Julian Price, Envisioning Community, Investing in People, premieres tomorrow night at the Orange Peel in Asheville. And I'm joined by the film's director, Aaron Durham, as well as Pat Whalen, the president of Public Interest Projects, and Meg McLeod, Julian Price's widow. So he was involved in every level, from fixing benches and planting flowers to financing to publicizing some of these issues, Meg. Very important stuff to him. Can I ask you about, you talked about his insecurities early on and his sense that he couldn't do enough, perhaps not enough to please his mother. He comes back to Asheville. He gets all these projects done. Passed away in 2001, so he hasn't even seen the full flourish of that city, although it was certainly coming around by then. What do you think, how is he feeling toward the end of his life about his goals and whether he had accomplished them?
Well, I think he was, well, I have to say that I believe the first, his healing, if you want to call it that, of whatever he came in with, started in California. And then when I just want to say clearly that when he would get flack from the city, one person said that he was threatening. His letters were threatening, even though they were very, very polite. He would have to go into his room, shut the door, and just stay there for, you know, a while and maybe only come out for meals. Because it was just very, very hard for him, but he would keep going. And then finally he was needing to get doing something else besides City Watch, and it was hard for him to quit because a lot of people loved it, but that's another story. But he finally got the strength to quit it, and he began playing golf, which had been a lifelong passion for him, although he had stopped it when he was in his 20s, I think, because, as he told me, it's not good for the environment. And I think another reason he stopped it was because people make fun of people who play golf. I mean, that's what he said, basically, because it's a rich white guy's game, so to speak. So he started playing golf again, and it was through golf that he really – it was a long, long process for him to even be able to play golf in town. That's another story. But by the time he was able to finally play golf in town at the country club, which he had sworn he would never do because that only rich white guys play there. Julian, you are a rich white guy. Then finally he was able to play also with people that he liked and beat them. And that was that last year of his life, or a year and a half, he was really in a good place with who he was. And he was okay about having a good time and being able to enjoy life.
Meg McLeod, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Meg McLeod is Julian Price's widow. Pat Whalen is the president of Public Interest Projects. Thank you, Pat.
It's a pleasure being here.
And Aaron Durham directs the documentary Julian Price, Envisioning Community Investing in People. Aaron, good to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
The documentary debuts at the Orange Peel in Asheville tomorrow night at 7:30. We have all the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Stay with us on the State of Things. We're talking about North Carolina barbecue next. Stay tuned.